The following message is entitled, Let My People Go. It is the third in Bishop John W. Howe's series, Meditations on Exodus.
Examination we've been giving to the person of Moses. There is a mighty drama that is beginning to unfold around him. And I have given you just a little bit more of an overview here. We could break the book into parts in a variety of ways. The calling of Moses is a subpart of the whole first section, the deliverance from Egypt, the Exodus per se. And just to kind of go through that, in that first section, the first 15 chapters, we start with Israel's oppression, Moses' birth, the miraculous way in which he is protected and rescued from death, his education, and then his flight into Midian, God's call and his reluctance to accept it. That's what we've been looking at so far. From there we'll move on into today the tenfold confrontation with Pharaoh. Then there are directions for the Passover, leaving of Egypt, the sanctifying of the firstborn, the crossing of the Red Sea, and the Song of Moses, thought by many to be the oldest piece of literature in the Bible. Obviously, we have stories that predate it, but that may well be the actually oldest piece of literature, the song that Moses sang and led the people to sing when, in fact, they had successfully gotten over the crossing of the Red Sea. That's the whole first section, the deliverance from Egypt. Then we have a smaller section, second part of chapter 15 through chapter 18, the journey to Sinai. The bitter waters of Marah are made sweet, and we have the murmuring of the people. It's a consistent theme for the next 40 years, the people murmuring in spite of God's tremendous deliverance, time after time stretching forth his hand to provide and to save. They grumble, they complain, oh, it was better for us back there in Egypt. God's providing of manna, supernatural bread from heaven. Giving of instructions about the Sabbath, striking the rock at Horeb to obtain water, the battle with the Amalekites, and Jethro becoming advisor to Moses. Interesting turnabout. To Moses, at the point of his tremendous leadership, Jethro, his father-in-law, gives him advice and Moses accepts it. And then we have the prayer of Moses at that point. And then the giving of the covenant and the law, the Ten Commandments, and then, as I said in our first session, that very long, seemingly disproportionate section about the building of the tabernacle in the wilderness. Tremendous amount of detail from God about all the furniture, all the altar, the court, the priestly garments, all of the various paraphernalia that pertain to worship. And then the section ends with the consecrating of the tabernacle and Moses literally backing out, starting at the centermost part of the tabernacle and consecrating it from the inside out. And so ends the book. We left off considering the call of Moses in chapter 5. Moses has gone to see Pharaoh for the first time, first of many times. And he said, let my people go. God commands us to go worship him in the wilderness. Let my people go. And Pharaoh's response is, let them go. I'll let them make bricks without straw. He says, they're just lazy. They don't want to work. That's why they want to go off into the wilderness. Somebody came up after the last session and pointed out to me an archaeological note in Halley's handbook that I jotted down, that in 1883 and 1908, researchers found at Pithom the lower courses of brick filled with good chopped straw, the middle courses with less straw, and that was stubble plucked up by the roots, and the upper courses of brick were of pure straw, pure clay, having no straw whatsoever. So a rather remarkable correspondence with the biblical account. I'll let them make bricks without any straw and they won't decrease their output one bit. That's where we left off last time. Look at chapter 5 and verse 22. And Moses turned again to the Lord and said, O Lord, Why have you mistreated this people? Why did you ever send me? Since I first came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has mistreated this people, and you have done nothing at all to deliver your people. God has promised Moses that he'll be with him. He'll provide for him. He'll even enable him to speak. And yet Moses goes up to Pharaoh and gets only grief for his efforts. I encourage you to read chapter 6 very carefully. Notice the reply. Before we see any of this worked out in detail, just listen to the first couple of paragraphs. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I shall do." If you have your own Bible, you might want to just circle every time the word I comes up in the next couple of paragraphs. "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. Indeed, by a mighty hand he will let them go. By a mighty hand he will drive them out of his land." God also spoke to Moses and said to him, "I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, El Shaddai. But by my name, the Lord, Yahweh, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they resided as aliens. I have also heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are holding as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will free you from the burdens of the Egyptians and will deliver you from slavery to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with a mighty act of judgment. I will take you as my people, and I will be your..." On and on it goes. I will do this. It's not dependent on you, Moses. Not dependent on Pharaoh. I will do this. Neither the Israelites nor the Pharaoh believed it at first. That didn't change a single thing. Do you believe that God keeps his promise? Sometimes it seems like it takes a very long time. And his word to us is, be faithful. If the vision tarry, wait for it. Wait for it. I am a God who keeps my promise. In chapter 7, Aaron throws down the rod of God before Pharaoh. He's been given this miraculous sign. Throw it down, it will turn into a serpent. Pick it up again, it will be the rod again. Look at verse 8. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "When Pharaoh says to you, 'Perform a wonder,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, and it will become a snake.'" So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did as the Lord had commanded. Aaron threw down his staff before Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. Then Pharaoh summoned the wise men and the sorcerers, and they also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same by their secret arts. That's no big deal, Moses. My magicians can do the same thing. That's just a little parlor trick. So they throw down their staffs, and they also become serpents. Each one threw down his staff, and they became snakes, but Aaron's staff swallowed up theirs. Still, Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. There's a pattern set here, and it will persist through the first of the several plagues that come upon Egypt. God visits this people with some devastating sign of his judgment, and Pharaoh's response to it is, "That's no big deal. My magicians can do the same thing." I have to wonder about Pharaoh's intelligence at this point. I mean, if he really has magicians who can do these supernatural things, wouldn't you think that rather than duplicating them, he'd reverse them? But he doesn't do that. So we have a series, what I call 10 confrontations, 10 warnings from God, 10 refusals from Pharaoh to heed the warning, and then 10 demonstrations that God meant exactly what he said. And it gets worse and worse. It gets more and more devastating. Let's just go through them quickly. You can read, it's only about 4 chapters in the Bible. You can read it for yourself in detail. The first sign is that of turning the water into blood. And as I said, Pharaoh is not impressed. He says, my magicians can do the same thing, and whatever water wasn't turned into blood, they turned into blood. Wouldn't you think that they'd turn it back into drinking water? They don't do that. Second one, frogs come up and cover the land. They duplicate that. You think that's a big deal? We can produce frogs too. Third one, gnats come in the wake of the frogs. They produce more gnats. The magicians of Pharaoh can only hang in there for the first three rounds. After that, there's no more duplication of these. Then there's a plague of flies, then the death of cattle, then everyone is covered with boils and sores, hail and fire, locusts. Think of locusts being everywhere. You can't take a step without crushing them underfoot. They devour everything. And as they begin to die, as you try to get rid of them, they're just a stench throughout the land. And the plague of darkness for 3 days, and then the worst of all, the death of the firstborn. From the household of Pharaoh to the household of the most menial servant to the firstborn of the flocks and herds. Several notes about all of this. Number one, the plagues were, among other things, a mocking of the false gods of Egypt. You need to see that. It gives an added dimension to what's going on. The Nile itself was considered to be a principal god, a life giver to the whole area. There is very little of Egypt that is arable land at all because it is in such a desert part of the world. It's only very close to the Nile, and the Nile overflowing its banks would provide for the next season of planting. It is absolutely the life stream for the whole nation. And to turn the Nile into blood is a mockery of this life-giving river, and therefore the god who is personified by the river. Frogs were considered gods until they covered the land. The chief god of Canaan was what? The golden calf. The bull was the chief god. And to have the death of cattle is an enormous mockery of the gods of Egypt. When darkness blots out the sun, it is blotting out the sun god, Re, or Ra. And when the death of the firstborn reaches all the way into Pharaoh's own household, the pharaohs being considered living gods here on earth, you're touching not only the government, but you're touching religion as well. So that's the first note. The plagues are holding up the falseness of the gods of Egypt and holding them up to scorn. Second thing I want you to see is Pharaoh's initial response being bravado in the face of what he considers magic. Not the Orlando magic, but the Egyptian magic. You think that's a great trick? My magicians can duplicate it, and so they do for the first three go-rounds. You really do have to wonder about all that. After the second plague, and the frogs are everywhere, these burping frogs croaking all over the place, Pharaoh begs Moses, call off your frogs! And Moses says, when? And he says, tomorrow. This is not a bright Pharaoh. I mean, wouldn't you say, now! Get them out of here! He says, tomorrow. We'll live with them for a day. Thirdly, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. I commented on this last time. It says in several passages, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Chapter 9, verse 12, chapter 10, verse 1, and so on. God hardened Pharaoh's heart. But over against that, or alongside of it, it has other passages that say Pharaoh hardened his own heart. Chapter 8, verse 15. Chapter 8, verse 32, chapter 9, verse 34, and so on. Which was it? Did God harden his heart, or did Pharaoh harden his own heart? From Pharaoh's point of view, what he was doing was calling the shots himself. He was not being manipulated by God. He was not a marionette or a puppet. He was not being forced to do something that he wouldn't otherwise do. He made the decision to say no to Moses. From God's point of view, God is in control. And I suggested last time, God is like the psychiatrist who is provoking the patient to surface whatever is there that needs to be dealt with. And you need to understand that God's purposes are always redemptive. Had there been the hope for repentance there, I'm sure that would have been a very different ending to the story. But God is surfacing in allowing Pharaoh to harden his heart. He's surfacing a rebellion that needs finally to be dealt with, and dealt with decisively. Lots of people have questioned, is it fair of God to bring plagues on a whole nation simply because one man hardened his heart, their leader? And I have two things to say about that. First of all, God always deals with people through their leaders. And he always deals with leaders through their people. And most of the time we get what we deserve in terms of our leadership. That may send a chill up and down your spine, but I think that's fairly true as a generalization. God deals with nations through their leaders. And if the leader is the wrong leader, he will be deposed or voted out of office, or there will be some uprising, and he will deal with the leader through the people. That is simply a principle that you can trace throughout all of Scripture, and I believe indeed throughout all of history. Second point, if you want a fascinating parallel, ask yourself whether it was just of the coalition to deal with the people of Iraq because of our quarrel with Saddam Hussein. I want to look at Pharaoh's response. No, you may not go. He says that after the first request in chapter 5. Let them go, not a chance. We'll double their workload. Instead of providing straw, now they're going to have to go find their own straw and keep the output of bricks just the same as it always was. Moses comes three times again, and three times again Pharaoh says, no, you may not go. After the plague of blood, after the plague of frogs, after the plague of gnats. There's a brief season in Virginia in about late April, early May, when we have gnats. Just about a week, you go out and you have to breathe through your teeth like this, you say. Can you picture gnats everywhere? I mean, so thick that you sort of have to go like this to see in front of your face. And he says, no, you may not go. But look at chapter 8, verse 25. After the fourth plague of flies, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, go, sacrifice to your God within the land. Stay within the borders of Egypt. But Moses said, it would not be right to do so, for the sacrifices that we offer to the Lord our God are offensive to the Egyptians. If we offer in the sight of the Egyptians sacrifices that are offensive to them, will they not stone us? We must go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he commands us. So Pharaoh said, I will let you go to sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness, provided you do not go very far away. Pray for me. Moses said, as soon as I leave you, I will pray to the Lord that the swarms of flies may depart tomorrow from Pharaoh, from his officials, from his people. Only do not let Pharaoh again deal falsely by not letting the people go. So Moses went out from Pharaoh and prayed to the Lord. The Lord did as Moses asked. He removed the swarms of flies from Pharaoh, from his officials, from his people. Not one remained. But Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also and would not let the people go. Do you see the interaction here? God saying, if you don't let them go, I'm going to visit you with trouble. He says, I won't let you go. The trouble comes. He says, I'll let you go. God takes away the plague, and then he hardens his heart again and says, no way, not going to let him go. So after four, his initial response is go, but only within the boundaries of Egypt. Then he says, go ahead into the wilderness, but not far, but he relents. After the plague of locusts in chapter 10, verse 7, Well, let's back up. Just get the flavor of this. Verse 3, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go, so that they may worship me. For if you refuse to let my people go, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your country. They shall cover the surface of the land so that no one will be able to even see the land. They shall devour the last remnant left you after the hail. And they shall devour every tree of yours that grows in the field. They shall fill your houses, the houses of all your officials and of all the Egyptians, something that neither your parents nor your grandparents have seen from the day they came on earth to this day." Then he turned and went out from Pharaoh. If you won't let us go, this is going to happen. Here's your chance. Let them go. Pharaoh's officials said to him, "How long shall this fellow be a snare to us? Let the people go. We have seen by this time that when he says there's going to be trouble, there's trouble." And even the officials are urging Pharaoh to let him go. "Let him go so that they may worship the Lord their God. Do you not yet understand that Egypt is ruined?" So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, "Go! Worship the Lord your God." But which ones are to go? Moses said, "We will go with our young and our old. We will go with our sons and daughters and with our flocks and our herds, because we have the Lord's festival to celebrate." He said to them, "The Lord indeed will be with you if ever I let your little ones go with you. Plainly, you have some evil purpose in mind. No, never. Your men may go and worship the Lord, for that is what you are asking, but not your kids. Leave your kids here." After the plague of darkness, blotting out of the sun, blotting out of the sun God, darkness over the whole land for 3 days, he says, "Go, but leave your flocks behind." And at each point, Moses says, "No. We've got to go as the Lord has told us. We've got to go into the wilderness, not within Egypt. We've got to go with our children, not just the adults. We've got to go with our flocks and our herds." Take that verse that I just read you up in verse 9 and add to it over in verse 26, and you see the steadfastness of Moses. "We will go with our young and our old, with our sons and our daughters, with our flocks and our herds. Our livestock also must go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind. For we must choose some of them for the worship of the Lord our God, and we will not know what to use to worship the Lord until we will arrive there." But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was unwilling to let them go. Pharaoh said to him, "Get away from me. Take care that you do not see my face again, for on the day you see my face, you shall die." Moses says, "We're going to do it God's way. We're not going to do it on any compromised basis." And so we have the most devastating of all the plagues, the death of the firstborn. Mind you, where this whole story began. At the time of the birth of Moses, there was a plague of the death of the firstborn Israeli children, wasn't there? The death of every son. If it's a son, get rid of him. Not just the firstborn, every son, lest they rise up and become an army against us. Pharaoh and his nation are getting back in kind what was their own policy. I want to look at chapter 12. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall mark for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell the whole congregation of Israel that on the 10th of this month they are to take a lamb for each family, a lamb for each household. And if a household is too small for a whole lamb, it shall join its closest neighbor in obtaining one. The lamb shall be divided in proportion to the number of people who eat it." And he goes on at great length about the preparation of the lamb. And then verse 14, "This day shall be a day of remembrance for you. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall observe it as a perpetual ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats unleavened bread from the first day until the seventh day shall be cut off from Israel." He's telling him in advance how they are to commemorate this day in future years of remembering it. On the first day you shall hold a solemn assembly, and on the seventh day a solemn assembly. No work shall be done on those days, only what everyone must eat. That alone must be prepared by you. You shall observe the festival of unleavened bread. For on this very day I brought your companies out of the land of Egypt. You shall observe this day throughout your generations as a perpetual ordinance. In the first month, from the evening of the 14th day until the evening of the 21st day, you shall eat unleavened bread. For 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses, for whoever eats what is leavened shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether an alien or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing leavened. In all your settlements you shall eat unleavened bread. What's the principal feature of the Passover meal, the first Passover meal? What was the principal feature of it? Passover lamb, wasn't it? And they weren't only to eat the lamb. The most significant part of that was they were to take the blood of the lamb and they were to sprinkle it or actually paint it on the sides of the doorway and over the lintel across the top. Why? So that when the angel of death comes through, he sees the blood and he passes over that house. Presumably none of the Egyptians have put blood on their doorposts and lintels. And then they're to eat the lamb, and given great detail about eating this lamb. And yet, strangely, it's not called, as God goes on to give instructions about celebrating this feast in years to come, it's not called the Feast of the Passover Lamb. It's called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Isn't that interesting? Why all this attention to no leaven, no yeast? Two reasons. Number one, yeast is in and of itself a symbol of corruption for the Jews. It is, in fact, an agent of decay. I don't know if you all know that. Probably the chefs and cooks among us are aware of that. But when leaven starts to work, for instance, in bread dough or even in alcoholic beverages, it is actually producing the first stages of decay. And that's why beer, for instance, is carbonated. There is a decay process at work there. If it doesn't go too far, it's great. But it is, in fact, a symbol of decay and corruption. And so throughout the scriptures for the Jews and right on into the ministry of Jesus, leaven is not always, but almost always, a symbol of political or religious corruption. Jesus says, "Be not leavened with the leaven of the Pharisees," for instance. Symbol of corruption. But secondly, leaven takes time to work. And this bread is to be eaten in haste. Don't wait for it to do its work of leavening the lump. Eat it in haste. Be ready to go on a moment's notice. You're to eat this bread and this lamb with staff in hand, shoes on your feet, ready to go when God gives the signal. Then Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go select lambs for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and touch the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood in the basin. None of you shall go outside the door of your house until morning, for the Lord will pass through to strike down the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over that door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to strike you down. You shall observe this rite as a perpetual ordinance for you and your children. When you come to the land that the Lord will give you, as he has promised you, you shall keep this ordinance. And when your children ask you, 'What do you mean by this observance?' you shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, for he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he struck down the Egyptians but spared our houses.' And the people bowed down and worshipped. The Israelites went and did just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron." Jewish celebration of Passover begins this week. This Saturday begins the Jewish Passover, right in the middle of our holiest of weekends, right in between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. It's very dramatic to rehearse again these mighty events and to realize that it was this meal that Jesus celebrated with his disciples on that first Maundy Thursday. Passover is remembered for the lamb's blood on the door. And if you have eyes to see it, it really does form a sort of a cross, doesn't it? Dripping down as it is up on the lintel, dripping down the middle of the door and splashed on the two side posts. There's a bloody cross right there on the houses of the faithful. We, who have put our trust in Christ, are figuratively speaking under the blood of the Lamb, His blood, a greater Passover Lamb. We are those who have been passed over by the angel of death because we have come under the blood of Christ. But as I said, Passover is not called the Feast of the Lamb, interestingly enough. And most Jews, when they celebrate it, don't eat lamb today. Some do, but most will eat chicken or something else. It's called the Feast of Unleavened Bread for all the reasons that I just summarized. And I just want to capture for you again and make it so vivid as we're about to rehearse these events again this very Holy Week, that this meal on the eve of Jesus' betrayal was a meal that had been celebrated for centuries going back to the time of Moses. And it already had this significance to it. We are remembering again what happened when our nation really, in a very real sense, became a nation. Its birth event was that of being delivered from Egypt. And God led us out by His mighty hand and spared us from the angel of death. And we're rehearsing that. And we are breaking this bread, remembering that first bread that was to be eaten in haste and not to be corrupted with any of the leaven of corruption. And so it was that Jesus took the Passover bread. You got it? And as He broke it, He said, "Never again will you celebrate the Passover meal without identifying Me with that deliverance." He gives it a new meaning. He infuses it with a deeper deliverance, a bigger Passover, a mightier delivery. And He took the cup, which was always drunk at the close of the meal, a cup of wine celebrating joy, thanksgiving. And He said, "This cup is what? The new covenant in My blood." So every time you eat this bread and drink this cup, you show forth His death. Well, we've done that. We've taken it out of that setting, and we celebrate it at least weekly and sometimes many more times than that. We eat it, we drink it in remembrance of Him. But bear in mind, in its first sharing, it already had all of this significance. And Jesus is saying, you will never again be able to think about what happened at the beginning of our story without identifying it with Me. I am there. I have been there, unseen. I and the Father are one. When He delivered the Israelites from slavery in Egypt, it was simply a prefigure of what I've come to do. And when I give My life on the cross, there will be another splashing of blood over the doorposts and lintel of each of your houses. You might even picture yourself as being in a doorway with the blood of Christ protecting you. You and I, having sinned against a holy God, deserve nothing less than death. But in His grace and His mercy, He says, "I've allowed another to take that death upon Himself. Put your trust in Him, and you go free." Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast.